Today's material is a comprehensive document proposing life-coherent spirituality, which is basically a framework that regrounds spiritual practices and beliefs in the preservation and flourishing of biological, social, and ecological life.
Right. And let's jump straight into the critique here. Because looking at the big picture, the material possesses a profound poetic resonance that occasionally conflicts with its stated identity as an academic white paper.
Yeah, it really does. Reading this feels a bit like listening to a sweeping poetic symphony being played in a corporate boardroom. I mean, the beauty is undeniably there, but the setting feels slightly mismatched.
Exactly. The core weakness here is that explicitly labeling this an academic white paper sets a very rigid, uncompromising reader expectation before they even read a single word of the text.
Oh, totally. Because when an expert audience opens a white paper, their brains automatically load a specific cognitive schema, right?
Yes, exactly. They are bracing themselves for empirical data, actionable policy prescriptions, highly concrete case studies. But the prose here frequently shifts into this highly theoretical, philosophical, almost manifesto-like register.
Right, we get these deeply poetic meditations on the great spiritual inversion.
Which are beautiful, but it creates massive cognitive friction for the reader regarding how to actually utilize the text. They're expecting an engineering blueprint, and they're receiving a philosophical treatise.
The tension jumps right off the page. As a reader, I found myself constantly stopping to ask, wait, am I supposed to be implementing this as a localized policy, or am I supposed to be meditating on this as a universal spiritual truth?
Yeah.
And the friction isn't happening because the writing is poor. I mean, the writing is incredibly evocative. It happens because the packaging of the document makes a promise about utility that the content simply doesn't keep.
Well, authors often default to the white paper label because they crave institutional legitimacy, you know?
Right. If you're writing about a paradigm shift in spirituality, there's a very real fear of being dismissed by the academic establishment as, like, overly mystical or ungrounded.
So the instinct is to just dress the philosophy up in a corporate suit to force people to take it seriously. But that armor ends up weighing the text down.
So how do we fix it?
The suggestion here is to reconcile this genre tension by making a definitive choice. You either ground the philosophical assertions in concrete empirical case studies to justify the white paper label, or you explicitly abandon the white paper framing altogether to reframe the document as a foundational philosophical or spiritual treatise.
Okay, let's look at concrete examples of how both of those paths could actually be executed on the page. Say they want to keep the white paper format.
If they keep it, they have to anchor the abstraction. For example, look at the section on spirituality as institutional self-preservation.
Right, which currently reads as a high-level critique of how institutions prioritize their own survival over human flourishing.
Exactly. To make that a white paper, you need to drop in a brief, anonymized case study. Give us a specific, real-world example of a massive healthcare network that, say, optimized its administrative billing software to minimize patient contact time, purely to sustain its own administrative bloat.
Oh. That makes sense. Show us the data, outline the mechanism of how that self-preservation overrides life capacity, and detail the real-world fallout.
Right. But consider the alternative path. What if we strip away the corporate suit entirely?
If they lean into the philosophical treatise angle.
Yes. A concrete example of execution there would be to remove the executive summary entirely and replace it with the traditional academic introduction.
Oh, wow. Yeah, because an executive summary belongs to a board of directors, you know? It's designed to be skimmed by people who don't have time to care about the nuance.
Precisely. An introduction belongs to a philosophy. It invites the reader to sit down, slow their pacing, and engage with complex ideas. Just changing that one structural heading signals to the reader that they are about to read a manifesto, not a quarterly report.
That choice fundamentally dictates how a reader digests the philosophy. And honestly, this crisis of identity, trying to be a corporate document and a spiritual text at the exact same time, it directly creates the next major issue in the material.
Which is the structure?
Yeah, the text introduces a multitude of intricate frameworks that risk overwhelming the reader's cognitive capacity. I wonder if, in the noble attempt to map every corner of this philosophy, the text is actually burying its own lead. Like, are we risking losing the forest of life-coherent spirituality by planting too many trees of secondary frameworks?
It's a great question. The weakness is that the piece aggressively layers multiple numbering systems and theoretical structures right from the outset.
Right, and just the opening pages were asked to track four major theoretical streams.
Yeah, Humberto Maturana, John McMurtry, Johann Galtung, and the medical ecological model.
And immediately after that, we're hit with the nine variations of the great spiritual inversion.
Then the 12 principles of life coherent spirituality.
And finally, the sevenfold grammar of coherence. It's just, it's too much.
It really is. It creates a structural pileup that aggressively competes for the reader's working memory, and ultimately it obscures the central brilliant thesis of life value.
I mean, my working memory completely capped out by page four. It felt like being handed the keys to 12 different cars before I had even been taught how to drive.
Let's unpack some of this dense terminology to understand why it's so heavy. Take John McMurtry's Life Value onto Axiology.
The concept itself is a brilliant lens. It's essentially the argument that our entire system of valuing things needs to be rooted exclusively in whatever sustains and enriches life rather than what generates profit.
Right, and right next to it, we get Humberto Maturana's structural coupling, which describes the biological reality that organisms and their environments are constantly adapting to each other in a continuous feedback loop.
Both concepts are incredibly profound. But the author drops them on us in the executive summary before we even understand why we need a new value system in the first place.
When cognitive load maxes out like that, comprehension just drops off a cliff.
Totally. As a reader, I stopped engaging with the actual meaning of McMurtry and Maturana's words and just started trying to survive the architecture of the text. I was just trying to remember if I was on principle number four or grammar rule number six.
So the suggestion here is to streamline the structural architecture by subsuming the secondary frameworks into the primary narrative arc. Allow them to emerge organically as supporting evidence rather than presenting them as standalone front-loaded lists.
Right. We aren't asking the author to delete these brilliant thinkers. We are asking them to completely change the timing of their arrival.
Exactly. Let's look at concrete examples of how to fix that timing. Instead of introducing Galtung, Maturana, and McMurtry all at once in the abstract, deploy their theories only when they're needed to solve a specific problem in the text.
Okay, like Johann Galtung's concept of positive peace. Positive peace isn't just the absence of war, it's the active presence of structures that prevent violence and promote equity.
Right. Now, Galtung is introduced at the very beginning as a foundational pillar. Instead, wait, don't mention him until you reach the regulation step of the sevenfold grammar later in the document.
Ah, I see. Let the reader encounter the inherent difficulty of societal regulation first.
Yes, build up the problem of how we govern ourselves without resorting to punitive violence. Once the reader feels the weight of that problem and they're actively looking for a solution, hand them Galtung's positive peace as the key to unlock it.
That's brilliant. You turn the theorist from an upfront reading assignment into a rescue mission.
Exactly. And the exact same strategy works for Maturana. Bring in Maturana's biology of love exclusively to support the section on perception.
Right. Don't give the reader complex theories of structural coupling on page three. Introduce the crisis of modern perception first, how we view ourselves as separate from the earth.
Let the reader feel the isolation of that worldview. Then offer Maturana's biological framework as the lens to see through it. It transforms the frameworks from a barrier to entry into a supportive scaffold.
It holds the reader up exactly when they need it.
Now, that overwhelming macro structure of throwing every framework at the wall is actually mirrored at the micro level, right down to the rhythm of the sentences.
Okay, let's get into the tone and style.
A heavy reliance on repetitive, contrasting sentence structures artificially paces the reading experience and dilutes long-term impact.
Yeah, reading it feels like using a bright yellow highlighter on every single sentence of a book. The contrasting rhetorical style is incredibly powerful at first, but when everything is highlighted, eventually nothing stands out.
Let's dig into the actual syntactic mechanics of this weakness. The text frequently relies on rapid-fire anaphora, which is repeating words at the start of neighboring clauses, alongside these very rigid, it does not do X, it does Y formulations.
Right. We see lines like, it does not ask human beings to escape, it asks instead, or these heavily repetitive lists. A competitive world trains suspicion. A caring world trains trust. A punitive world trains concealment.
Over a short speech, that staccato rhythm is mesmerizing. It sounds like a sermon. But over a document of this length, This transforms from a striking rhetorical device into a predictable, fatiguing rhythm.
Recognizes the X not Y formula after the third or fourth time, it stops reading the nuance of the words. It just starts skimming for the contrast.
I want to push back on this a bit, though, because when I read those repetitive lists, it felt deeply intentional, like it mimics a religious litany or a chant. For a document proposing a great spiritual inversion, shouldn't it have that liturgical rhythm?
I hear that. The urgency of the crisis we are facing ecologically demands a passionate, relentless delivery. And the passion is the lifeblood of this material. But we have to evaluate how the medium affects the message.
What do you mean?
In a spoken format, a litany commands attention because you have the speaker's vocal inflection, their pauses, their physical presence. But in a written text, reading requires internal voicing.
Oh, right.
When the reader's internal voice is forced into a relentless, hammering march for dozens of pages, there is no room left for the natural ebb and flow of contemplation. The listener covers their ears if you shout every single word. The chant inevitably becomes a drone.
So the passion actually works against itself if it isn't modulated.
Exactly. The suggestion then is to vary the syntactic rhythm to provide the reader with more natural breathing room, reserving these highly stylized contrasting structures exclusively for the most critical paradigm shifts to preserve their rhetorical punch.
Variation is what keeps a reader leaning in. You speak softly and conversationally to draw them close, and then you deploy that striking contrast to deliver the paradigm shift when you know they're paying full attention.
Right. Let's look at a concrete example of how to execute the syntactic variance on the page. Currently, the author lists rapid staccato contrasts in a row. The body is not an error. The earth is not a disposable stage. Dependency is not a humiliation.
It's a beautiful sentiment, but it is syntactically rigid and isolated.
So to improve this, the author needs to synthesize those rigid, standalone sentences into a flowing, compound narrative sentence.
Okay, so instead of the staccato list, it could be rewritten as, by reclaiming the body and the earth as sacred sites, life-coherent spirituality reframes human dependency not as a humiliation, but as the very locus of our connection.
Notice how changing that syntax actually reveals the underlying logic of the philosophy. By weaving the concepts together, the causality suddenly becomes crystal clear.
The body and earth being sacred is the foundational reason why dependency is not a humiliation.
Yes. In the original staccato version, the body is not an error, is sitting in an isolated box, entirely cut off from the concept of dependency. The staccato format severs a logical connection between the ideas by forcing them into separate rhythmic beats.
But the revised, flowing example restores the underlying mechanism, showing exactly how these concepts interact with one another.
It moves the text away from just loudly declaring things to actually explaining how they work together. It invites the reader to engage with the logic of life-coherent spirituality rather than just nodding along to the rhythm of the words.
By smoothing out the syntax in the transitional paragraphs, the author actually amplifies the power of the core thesis statements when they do decide to use that contrasting structure.
It is all about pacing the reader's revelation.
And pacing that revelation is ultimately what ensures this vital material actually takes root in the reader's mind. So, let's briefly recap the three high-level opportunities we explored today for strengthening this document. First, we address the need to resolve the genre tension.
Right. The document must decide if it's an empirical white paper rooted in data or a philosophical manifesto rooted in theory, and align its formatting to match that choice, thereby eliminating the cognitive friction.
Second, we looked at framework fatigue. We suggested streamlining the dense theoretical architecture by subsuming secondary frameworks into the primary narrative arc.
The key is changing the timing of their arrival, allowing theorists like Maturana and Galting to emerge organically exactly when the reader needs them to solve a problem.
And third, we examined the syntactic rhythm, suggesting the author vary the repetitive, staccato sentence structures. By smoothing out the relentless X not Y phrasing into flowing, compound sentences, the text will prevent reader fatigue.
It'll reveal the underlying causality of the arguments and preserve its rhetorical power for the most critical paradigm shifts.
To the listener, these are all structural and pacing adjustments designed to maximize the impact of your incredibly deep expertise. Look closely at your formatting choices to clarify your genre right out of the gate.
Integrate your theorists as active problem solvers rather than upfront reading assignments. And give your sentences the necessary breathing room so your internal logic can shine through.
We warmly invite you to implement these suggestions, revise the text, and submit the work back to the critique for another round of feedback. We would love to see how this evolves because a symphony does not belong in a boardroom. It needs an acoustic space intentionally designed to let the music breathe, resonate, and ultimately transform the listener. See you next time.